This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After 20 years as a stock trader and serving as vice president of Goldman Sachs, Mark Smith left Wall Street to write. His first book is all about the street. It's a history of the American stock market from 1901 to the present, called Toward Rational Exuberance. It isn't an investment guide. Smith says his purpose is to help readers understand the modern stock market and the central role it plays in today's economy. The year his book begins, 1901, is the year he says marks the beginning of the modern stock market. U.S. Steel was formed that year, a trust that challenged investors' assumptions of how stocks should be valued.
Well, up to that point, and frankly, after that point to a large extent, but up to that point, stocks were evaluated strictly on the basis of the dividends they paid. Nobody really wanted to try to predict the future as we do routinely today, in part because accurate information wasn't available, in part because there was so much blatant manipulation and chicanery going on that nobody could trust the information that was made available. But U.S. Steel, when Morgan assembled that company, what he was trying to do was to say that, look, this company will be more efficient going forward. It will earn more in the future because of the way it's constituted. We can't just look at it as the sum total of the companies that were merged together to form U.S. Steel. We have to realize that as an ongoing entity, it will generate more earnings and it will be a different animal than what has gone before. And so that was the first inkling, I think, of the notion that stocks should be viewed for their future potential earnings, which is routine today. But people don't realize back at that time, if you tried to say, I'm going to anticipate what a stock is going to earn 2 or 3 years from now, you'd be accused of just engaging in speculation, that it was considered to be something that couldn't be done. All you looked at really was the dividend the company paid then and nothing else.
You said there was a lot of chicanery in this era in the stock market. Give us an example of what was going on.
Well, I have a number of stories in my book, but one of my favorite stories is a man by the name of John Gates, who ran a major steel company that was actually merged into U.S. Steel by J.P. Morgan. And what Gates did, this company was doing very well. The stock was selling at a high price. Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, he announced that he was closing 13 of his steel plants, presumably because business wasn't that very good. It wasn't that good. Now, obviously, that caught the market by surprise. The stock dropped sharply. But what had happened is that Gates had sold short the stock of that company, which is really, you know, the selling short is the reverse of buying. In a way, you're betting the stock is going to go down. He had sold short for his personal account, closed the plants, caused the stock to go down, then bought back his short to make a profit, then reopened the plants and went on doing business as he'd always had before. Now, this was a blatant manipulation. It would be, you know, completely illegal today, but that kind of thing happened all the time. It was considered to be routine back at the turn of the century. And for obvious reasons, the poor investor who was caught by that kind of manipulation, you know, couldn't be very trusting toward the way companies were managed or the kind of information that was available to him. Hence, you had to value stocks based on very conservative criteria.
And were there no laws governing the stock market then?
Very few. I mean, there were laws regarding fraud and a few things like that, but most of the regulations that existed were New York Stock Exchange regulations that grew up over time primarily to protect the members of the New York Stock Exchange, not the public.
How was business transacted on the stock market at the turn of the century? If you wanted to buy or sell a stock, what would you do?
Well, actually, you know, the New York Stock Exchange and the way it operates hasn't changed that much over the last 100 years. Now, NASDAQ being a separate market system is completely different. But the system of actually buying and selling stocks on the New York Stock Exchange is almost unchanged over the last century. Basically, there is a single post or a point where a given stock is traded. All the buy and sell orders come together at that particular post and are matched up. And that balance of supply and demand then causes the stock to either go up or go down. And, you know, obviously, there have been some changes in technology since then. But that fundamental open outcry auction system, which is the way it's defined, hasn't changed much in the last 100 years.
My guest is B. Mark Smith. He's a former stock market trader and author of the new book, Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. Let's talk about the Dow Jones Average. This was created at the turn of the century, where your book begins. It was created by who?
Charles Dow. And he actually was the owner and original editor of the Wall Street Journal and came up with the idea of creating an average. At first, it was of basically rail stocks, and he added a few industrial stocks, you know, which created what we know now as the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1896. And at that time, there were only 12 what he called industrial stocks that he felt were worthy of including in the average. Now the average is up to 30 today. But that was the only average that goes back that far in history. All the other market indices that we use today didn't get started until sometime later in the century. So for points of comparison in my book, I use the Dow as much as possible because it's the only one that's continuous over the course of the 100 years.
What was his intention when he put together the average?
To try to come up with some way of measuring the market, because up to that point, obviously, there were no calculators or computers, and everything was very primitive, and people really didn't have any way of knowing what the market was doing. You could observe individual stocks, but until somebody came up with an index to measure all the stocks, or at least representative stocks, there was no way to really give you a broad gauge of what the overall market was doing.
How do you think the Dow Jones average changed how people looked at the market?
Well, it made it possible to talk about the market. In other words, prior to that point, you could only talk about individual stocks. Now, or when the Dow was developed and subsequent averages, you could then say, well, the market did this or the market did that, as opposed to, say, U.S. Steel did this, and then just take U.S. Steel as a proxy for the market. So it gave a much more accurate means of assessing what was happening in the overall stock market.
Let's jump ahead a few years to Clarence Barron, who founded the financial weekly Barron's in 1921. You say one of his contributions is that he thought outside investors could invest successfully in stocks and not be adversely impacted by the machinations of market operators, as long as investors made solid long-term investment decisions based on sound economic fundamentals and stayed away from short-term speculation. Was that a new idea?
In a sense, in the early 1920s, Barron and a couple of other people begin to talk more about, you know, what I referred to earlier with U.S. Steel, in that, you know, people should look forward and anticipate what the market was going to do as opposed to just judging it based on the dividends that stocks currently paid. You started to see slowly in the first few decades of the 20th century this idea become developed. Barron was one of the first people who actually, you know, stated it in his new publication, Barron's. It doesn't seem like it seems like common sense now. So much of what has developed over the last 100 years we just take as being obviously, intuitively obvious now. But at that time, you know, Barron's was trying to refute what was a widely perceived impression that because the market was subject to so much manipulation, investors just couldn't possibly succeed in it. They just were playing a losing game. And his notion was that in the long run, stocks were going to grow with the economy and with the growth in corporate profits, and the manipulation wasn't going to have any effect. So if you just tried to focus on the long run, you wouldn't be adversely impacted by the manipulators.
Of course, Barron had this idea and made this statement just a few years before the stock market crashed. So the long term wasn't really looking all that good.
Well, see, that's one of the things I try to deal with in the book is mythologies grow up over time about the market based on conventional wisdom that develops after the fact. And quite often that conventional wisdom turns out to be wrong. I mean, for example, you know, I spend quite a bit of time talking about the 1929 crash. And a lot of people would be surprised to know that that crash really wasn't much more severe than a number of other crashes that had occurred in the 19th century or some declines that have occurred since. For example, in 1987, in that crash, In one day, the market was down 23%, which was twice the decline of the largest single daily decline in 1929. And so the notion that somehow the 1929 crash was this disastrous event that had never happened before and somehow unique in financial history really isn't accurate. The only reason that people pay so much attention to it today is that it was followed by the Great Depression. It was the Great Depression that destroyed the stock market, not the 1929 crash.
So you don't think the crash helped cause the depression?
No. As a matter of fact, I argue quite strenuously that the crash did not cause the depression. It did not really even predict the depression because at the time, the state of economic knowledge was nowhere near sufficient to make that projection. And what people forget, again, that this gets lost in the mythology, is once the crash itself ended in mid-November 1929, the market rallied substantially and within about 3 or 4 months had gained back over half of what it had lost in the crash. So in March or April of 1930, somebody sitting there at that point in time could easily have said, well, the crash is gone. It's just another one of these declines or market breaks that we saw repeatedly in the 19th century. It really isn't that significant. Then, of course, the Great Depression came. That's what, you know, pulled the stock market down, but that was an entirely different animal.
So what's your theory about what caused the depression?
Well, I don't claim to be an economist, and economists still today argue about that. But basically, as I say very briefly in the book, that it, probably poor Federal Reserve monetary policy combined with a weak banking system that basically just collapsed under pressure, combined with some very bad protectionist trade legislation that stifled international trade, all these things together caused what would have been a normal cyclical downturn in the economy to turn into a depression. But again, the 1929 stock crash had virtually nothing to do with that, and it certainly could not have predicted the depression that happened later.
You write about a lot of evolutionary changes in the stock market over the past century, and I'm wondering if really immersing yourself in stock market history changed your idea in any fundamental way about how sound the stock market is and about how safe it is for the long term.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I've been interested in the stock market since I was 15 years old. And I would actually, when I was in high school and college, go back into the library and read through old newspaper accounts of the famous crashes in the 19th century or 1929 as an example. So when the 1987 crash occurred, and at that time I was a professional trader working at First Boston, and I was right in the middle of it. At one point, when I realized that the market was down over 20% on the day, and I realized that the largest single daily decline in 1929 had been only slightly over 12%, I said, wow. This is an important event. And I guess you could say that my knowledge of history and the fact that I'd spent so much time for my personal interest in studying stock market history caused me to look at an event in my professional life differently than I might otherwise have done.
Well, tell me more about what that day was like for you. Did you lose a lot of money personally? Did your clients lose a lot of money? What was on the line for you?
Well, basically, as a professional trader, I was trading for the firm's account. At that time, it was First Boston. You know, later, I moved to Goldman Sachs. So I was trading the firm's money. It wasn't really clients' money. And the kind of products that I was trading at that time, which were stocks and then convertible bonds relative to stocks, actually didn't do that badly, because in a sense we were playing relationships between different kinds of securities as opposed to just being, you know, owning stocks and watching them go down. But it was fascinating, because as I watched the numbers go down and realized what was happening, you almost had a sense of unreality. You know, people who've been involved in automobile accidents, for example, tell me that you seem like you're almost divorced from reality. You're floating up in the air someplace, sort of looking down at all the chaos around you. And that was sort of like the impression that I had when I was sitting here right in the middle of all this chaos and all these billions and hundreds of billions of dollars being lost. It was almost like, wow, could this really be happening? I know that sounds a little strange, but that's the way I reacted to it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is B. Mark Smith. He's the author of the new book, Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. He's a former trader and was a vice president at Goldman Sachs. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is B. Mark Smith. He's the author of the new book, Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. Now, you know, some reviewers have really taken you to task for coming up with this title, Toward Rational Exuberance, which is an answer to the whole irrational exuberance thing, which is both the title of a best-selling book and something that Alan Greenspan said to describe how he thought the market was behaving a couple of years ago, you know, irrationally exuberant. But now that you have your book, Toward Rational Exuberant, you know, the market has really been, you know, doing comparatively poorly. So, you know, a lot of book reviewers are saying, boy, the timing's really bad for this title.
Yeah, unfortunately, we couldn't control the timing. But it's interesting that I think that would fall into another case of what I call mythology about the stock market. For example, obviously, technology stocks have not done well in the last year or so. Or if somebody, you know, had all his portfolio invested in .com or internet stocks, then obviously they've been decimated. But if you look at the Dow Jones average, it's right around 11,000, which is only a few points away from its all-time high. If you look at the Standard & Poor's 500, which that index represents 90% of the market capitalization in this country, including a lot of technology stocks, it was down at one point a little over 20% last year, which barely meets the definition for a mild bear market. It's since come back. That is not at all a very serious decline by historical standards. I mean, when people talk about a bursting bubble or these huge losses that have supposedly been inflicted upon investors, they're really only talking about a certain narrow group of stocks, meaning the technology stocks, primarily the NASDAQ technology stocks, a few of the internet.com telecommunication stocks. The broader stock market as a whole has not done that badly at all. And that's what I try to do in my book. I don't gear my book towards a particular point in time. I'm not trying to say in my book that stock prices are too high or too low. What I'm trying to do is explain the process that's occurred over the last 100 years and put a lot of these myths in perspective. In my mind, a lot of the mythology about what supposedly happened in the market in the last year or so isn't accurate, because people are just looking at one particular segment of the market and using that as a means of generalizing to the market as a whole, which is not correct.
On the other hand, there seems to be a general economic downturn going on, and a lot of businesses are reporting losses. And those reported losses are affecting other businesses' stocks, because there's this general fear of a downward trend.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's happened before. I mean, we've had recessions before, and I'm sure we'll have it again.
A lot of people have money tied up in the market through their retirement funds. Mm-hmm. Well, what are your thoughts about how the market's going to be affected when the baby boom starts to retire and a lot of people start withdrawing their money from those retirement funds in the market?
Well, I think you'll actually see an effect before that. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that in the 1980s and 90s, as people have moved towards investing much more of their pension assets in the market, people have developed a longer-term time horizon. Obviously, if you're investing for retirement, you're not usually investing for money you're going to need in the next 4 or 5 years, so you can afford to ride out the risk. After the 1987 crash, for example, when a lot of people were worried that the average investor would panic and pull his money out of the market, that didn't happen. It's because people have bought into this notion that stocks are a good long-term investment and you don't worry about the short-term fluctuations. Hence, you're willing to take more risk. You're willing to invest a larger percentage of your assets in stocks. But as the baby boom generation, of which I consider myself a member, moves closer to retirement, we will become more risk averse. Even before we start taking the money actually out, like you suggest, we will start thinking, hey, I can't afford to take a 20 or 30 year time horizon anymore. I've got to be much more concerned about these short term fluctuations. Hence, maybe I should reduce the percentage of my portfolio that's invested in stocks. As we become more risk averse, I think that will dampen the rate of increase in the stock market going forward, even before the baby boomers actually start to withdraw their money. So that's a very major effect that I see coming in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
So tell me more about what you think that'll mean.
Well, I think what it means is you're not going to see the kind of rates of increase that we saw in the 1990s in the stock market. Part of the reason that the stock prices went up so fast in the 90s, obviously, is that the economy was doing very well. But beyond that, stocks rose even faster than the rate of growth in the economy or the rate of growth in corporate earnings because people were moving towards this willingness to take more risk. They're willing to put more of their portfolio in stocks because they had this long-term philosophy. They're willing to buy more speculative stocks because they had a longer-term time horizon. As the baby boom generation moves closer to retirement, even before they actually start taking the money out, I think you'll see a reversal of that process, which means if people take less risk, if they want to own fewer stocks in their portfolio, the stock market won't go up as fast as it has in the past. In fact, I think it'll probably only go up roughly as fast as corporate earnings do in the future, which historically is about 7% or so.
President Bush supports the proposal of investing Social Security money in the stock market. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, actually, both Bush and Gore proposed ways of using federal tax dollars to subsidize investment in the stock market. The primary difference between Gore's proposal and Bush's proposal was that Gore proposed to do it outside of the Social Security system and use general tax revenues, and his proposal was also slightly more tilted towards lower income individuals. But both of them, in essence, accepted the notion that the federal government should in some way or another subsidize through the use of tax dollars, whether they're Social Security tax dollars or general revenue tax dollars, the idea of investing in the market. And I think it makes sense in a limited way because the returns that this typical Social Security investor gets now or the Social Security participant gets now are so poor historically that even if you make the more conservative assumptions that I'm making about what the market is going to do in the future, it's hard to see a scenario where you're going to get less than 2%, which is basically what the Social Security participants have been getting up to this point. So in a limited sense, I think both the Bush and the Gore proposals make sense. And there's really not that much of a difference between the two other than that Gore tries to preserve the fiction, really, that he's doing it outside the Social Security system to preserve the so-called lockbox, whereas Bush does it within the Social Security system. But they both basically have endorsed the same idea. And I agree with it in a limited way.
Now that you're not a trader anymore, and now that you say most of your money is tied up in mutual funds, do you follow daily information very carefully?
I'll watch CNBC. I read the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, New York Times every day. And so I do, in part because I'm just naturally interested in it, in part because it might ultimately influence some investment decisions I make, and in part because I'm researching another book on the global stock market, so I need to be aware of these things. So all three of those factors come into play, but I do follow pretty closely, yes.
When you watch one of the financial shows and all the experts there are offering their stock tips, what do you think?
Some of my comments I probably couldn't make over the public airwaves, but I've always joked that a lot of these guys who are market prognosticators get up in the morning and they have three separate explanations for what's going to happen in the market that day. They have one that they'll use if the market goes up. They have another one they use if the market goes down. And they have another one they'll use if the market stays unchanged. And they wait till the end of the day, and then they pick the one that applies and they use that. So I don't have a lot of faith in the ability of people to make short-term market judgments, I think, and I've presented a lot of the evidence in my book. There's a surprising amount of data that shows that it's really very difficult to do that. And certainly my own 20 years of experience as a professional trader, where I, if anybody, should have been able to consistently outsmart the market on a short-term basis. And I never was able to, and I always thought I was a pretty good trader, and my employers did most of the time. So I take a lot of what is said on CNBC and some of these financial programs with a grain of salt. I guess that's the best way I can put it, diplomatically.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
B. Mark Smith is the author of the new book Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.